Bag huge savings on your painting projects at Menards. From your kitchen and bath to doors and trim, and even your ceilings, Dutch Boy has the perfect choice for your painting projects. Dutch Boy's DuraFighter is a tough paint and primer that provides great scrub resistance and durability. DuraFighter interior paint starts at $27.75 a gallon. Get an additional 15% savings on all Dutch Boy paints when you put it in the bag. See store for complete details.
Save big money at Menards.
Around we go, playing the game. Sell, move, use, be done. They want us to stay. Around we go, playing.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Irreplaceable Truths. Today, my guest, I've known since I graduated. He is a veterinarian based in Newport Beach, California. His name is Dr. George Kacharian, and whenever he used to call people on the phone, it would be Kacharian Veterinarian here. I remember that clear as day. I'm not going to give too much out about him right now because there's some amazing facts about him that I'd rather we talk about. But the one thing, George, that you don't know, and still my wife and I talk about to this day, when we graduated vet school, 2 months in, my father-in-law and mother-in-law got a chance, because my mother-in-law is a registered nurse, to go to Africa to do a scoliosis exams on kids. And out of nowhere, you were the one that called my wife and said, if you need anything, I will drop what I'm doing and I will be over there to help you immediately. To this day, out of nowhere, out of the blue, you heard her dad was going on a trip and you were going to be there. And we still talk about it to this day. So I can't thank you enough for that. That was amazing.
Thank you.
Okay, so George, let's go. Where were you born?
I was born in Cairo, Egypt in 1946.
1946. And where did you attend vet school?
Cairo University in Giza.
In Giza. And then English is what language for you?
English, actually, it was the second language medically speaking, it's the first language.
Okay. And then when did you come to the United States?
In 1973.
And you're, okay, so when did you start at your hospital that you currently own?
In 1978.
1978. And the one amazing fact that a lot of people don't know is, who did you work for?
I work for Dr. In Beverly Hills at Dr. Kagi and Kagi.
Okay.
It was a general practice. And I work for couple of other places. I don't remember their names. And then I came in Orange County. I worked for a humane society for a couple of months. And then I did a couple of nights as a night or evening shifts. And then the guy offered me the hospital for sale. It was an emergency hospital first, and when they opened the emergency clinic in Orange County, the first one, the big one, he went out of business, so he opened it as an evening clinic or like an evening. Nowadays, it's called the urgent care.
Correct.
Yes.
So when did you start working for Dr. Slocum?
Oh, I was going for Dr. Slocum after I volunteered with Dr. Bob Olds, who was a boarded surgeon for about 3 years. For 3 days, I used to go and help him out and be his assistant. And then I saw Dr. Slocum, so I went and I studied, and I was going to Dr. Slocum lots of times. So, because he figured out that I used his first
resident.
No, it was none of them gave me an official training, you know. And Bob Holder, he told me from the beginning, I can't give you an official. I told him, I don't care. I just want to be a great surgeon. That's it.
So for those, because for those young listeners listening.
Yeah.
What did Tom Slocum, what procedure did he perfect?
Yeah. Barclay Slocum was this orthopedic surgeon. He was a revolutionary guy. And he, let's say for the knees, every 6 months or 3 to 6 months, someone does a study. Okay, we got to use the fascia, half of the fascia, cut the patella, use metal, use extracapsular, intracapsular. All, every 3 or 6 months they were, and none of, in big dogs, none of them really worked well. So Dr. Slocum came in with his first approach of the TPLO, and he decided, and I was at the AVOR, which is, I used to be like a guest going to the AVOR meetings, which is an orthopedic foundation in the West Coast. So he saw me, how I like to practice and how I love orthopedics. So he educated me and he gave me the first license actually in the world, which is very good stuff.
So you were the first licensed veterinarian to do the TPLO procedure.
Yeah. It, at that time, you had to go and take Dr. Slocum's, Barclay Slocum's course. It's about 3 to 4 days, yeah. Something like that.
So if I was to ask you, how many TPLOs do you think you've done in your career so far?
Oh, my God. A few thousands, I think, 2,000 or 3,000 cases. I used to do them a lot when at the beginning. I started up. After he gave me the license, I attended the meeting afterwards a year later at the AVOR, and I presented 45 cases that I've done already. And then after that, every guy at the AVOR went to his class. For some reason, they didn't want to pay the $4,000. And he was giving us plates and
the saw?
The saw. He was giving us the material to do it, too, for $4,000 only. So some people, they thought, oh, it's his right to be given for free. And he was a capitalist. We're in a capitalist area. I said, I don't mind, of course. And then he did, before the TPLO, he did the first TPO plate that is a stair-stepping. And it was, you go and do your approaches. You do the pubic cut, the iliac cut, and the ilium cut, and then you go twist and put this the plate, because it was like stair steps. It had 3 degrees, 20, 30, and 40. And boom. And you save your dog's hip problems, but you have to get them early enough.
Early enough. They don't really do a lot of TPOs nowadays.
No, they... Well, I'm surprised. Not a lot, but I still believe in it. When we did the TPLO and a TPO, and everybody was doing the TPO at that time, because that was the end thing now, and especially with Dr. Slocum's plate, we came after 9 or 10 years and reevaluated the whole thing. And I presented the case that a dog that we did the TPO, and the same dog, we didn't do anything. And then I had another case, which is the dog, we did the TPO, and the other leg was an FHO. And in those cases, my TPO cases, even after 9 or 10 years, it has osteoarthritis a little bit, but he was using it so well and much better than the other leg that's not been operated or had an FHO.
Wow.
So that's why I believe in it. Some people say, oh, no, if you don't have 100% or 90% success rate, it's no good or you don't do it. And there's a lot of guys, you know, in the Midwest, they still do it, the professors. There's a neurology professor, I was talking about him in neurology. He says, I do TPO and this and this. I says, what? You do it? Because the guys in Florida, they wrote about it and they said, no, it really doesn't work. It does work.
What, the University of Florida?
Yeah, and they eliminated, I mean, you eliminate the total hip replacement surgery, which is maximum, you got 80% success rate, 95% success rate going out the door, but you got another 15%. You don't know what the dog will do or what's going to happen.
And then it turns out to be a very expensive FHO.
Besides, yeah, exactly, exactly. And I used to do them because I used to do them and I didn't like my results after 10 years. So I said, all right, to heck with it. I'm going to talk to my friend who is a professor in orthopedics at Davis, Dr. Vassar, Phil Vassar. I said, hey, let's do it together. So for 5 years, we were on part-time, we were doing it together, and we had different types of complications. So it's really, it's not very sad until up till now. And I have a lot of surgeons. They agree with me. Now, almost young surgeons like to do it because they feel, I do this, but
the time to cut is the time to cure.
Yeah.
So you come to this country, English medical was about the only thing you knew.
Yes.
How hard was it for you to get into exam rooms and talk to clients?
I really, talking to the clients, I had fun, but when I started doing surgeries, I had much more fun. Because when you do a case and they see how successful it was, you get respect the rest of your life.
Yeah. I well, because, you know, as I told you, I'm getting my doctorate now and I'm studying, you know, how fast early veterinarians leave the profession, right? They graduate and they're like, oh shit, I have to be a doctor. I just can't play with puppies and kittens. There's a lot that comes with the title veterinarian. So one of the problems is that it's the exam room. It's the client communication that's running them off. How did you get around that, not being from here?
Well, I did general practice for about 20 years or 15 years or 18 years. And then I exclusively did surgery afterwards. Like, I don't know the vaccine records or vaccine protocol nowadays or the worming protocol nowadays or what's the latest flea product or how to treat diabetes or so. I don't do that anymore. I don't have to deal with Cushing's and Addison's and all the things. I just do my surgeries, do knees, trauma, some neuro and stuff like that. But I have fun. And thank God, at the beginning, I had about once I counted the referral, I used to have 75 doctors referring me cases. But nowadays, there's a lot of boarded guys and stuff like that they took away, which is fantastic. Everybody, it's fun. I still have fun. I'm still busy in my practice. I'm 78 and enjoy my surgeries. I enjoy teaching my young doctors. Now I have one full-time, two part-timers. I like to teach them, even general surgery have progressed itself. Surgery itself progressed. Like, we used to do the space with sutures and stuff like that. Now we do the ligature. We go and coagulate and cut, coagulate and cut.
No, you sutures. Have a coagulation machine?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Several ones I use it exclusively. The electrocar is all kind of electrocar. I use it exclusively, and I add fun. It's fun. I mean, if you go and do your the spay itself is a big ass surgery.
It's not routine. There's
no
it's nothing routine.
If someone tells you it's routine, he's a freaking liar, or he works exclusively. And I used to work as a low-cost spare neuter clinic, so I used to do 20, 30 cases. But usually, it's a draining surgery, especially if it's a big dog, it's a draining surgery. Now, if you have the ligature, you go, take the ovaries, and grab it, you cauterize it, you cut it, and boom, you're gone.
So you would recommend young veterinarians looking for a job to go work somewhere where they have a surgeon on staff, because those are the only ones who can afford that machine. Those machines are expensive.
They were very expensive at the beginning, but nowadays, especially you don't have to buy a brand new machine, but now it's getting very reasonable. And I encourage my young guys, I have a medical equipment and supply company on the site to have fun. And I go ahead and get them from human hospitals, and I sell it to my colleagues too in a very reasonable price. And they like it. But the guns, they have to gas sterilize. So, yeah. And I gas sterilize a lot of equipment to my colleagues and some surgeons, the mobile surgeons, when they start.
So with the you're just such an interesting man, because you came to this country, you became a pioneer in a very sought after knee procedure, right? You're the first one licensed. I'll call you a pioneer. You taught me how to do an FHO, believe it or not. It just goes to show you can be very successful and still have a great time in this profession. Even if you come to this country, English is a second language.
Yeah.
You could still be very successful.
It's the opportunities that I got. I got the opportunities to get my license, and I got the opportunities when I went to my first surgeon. I told him, hey, I want to be the greatest surgeon in Orange County. He said, yeah, and come over and scrub in with me, but I'm not going to give you a paper or anything like that, or a residency certificate. Yeah. I said, I don't care, give a shit. I just enjoy surgery. And then he came in afterwards.
Right.
And now he's retired, but he came in afterwards after maybe 7 or 10 years. He said, George, You're doing better than me. You do stuff that I don't dream to do. So that's the greatest feeling.
Was that Tommy Walker?
No. Tommy Walker came in afterwards, and that was another Dr. Robert Olds. And Tommy Walker, I remember when he came in, he was having a problem with another doctor because they didn't get along. So I told him, come on, Tommy. come over and work at our emergency clinic. And he opened his place, and he opened his, he became very, very famous. And he came in, and we were doing some, we did some hips together, like total hips and stuff like that. And we had a good time, and it was in the newspaper, and it was fun.
Yeah, well, Tommy Walker went on to own a very, very, very lucrative specialty practice in Orange County. Taught at the University of Tennessee at the same time, right?
He was great.
While he was working.
Great neurologist. He was fantastic. And Tommy has such a great personality, some kind personality. And if you ask him, he knows very well who made him stay in California and have this big of a practice. We're very good friends, for me.
So you're so far the oldest guest that's been on the show. How have you seen veterinary medicine change? Let's keep it simple. Last 5-7 years.
Veterinarians, like new veterinarians?
New veterinarians, the veterinary profession, anything.
It's a change to the new things, like, you know, it's the corporations came in and gave prices to the general practitioner that he can't dream about, because if someone wanted to buy, let's say, is making $1 million, and if he gives it to his colleague or someone else, well, the colleague has to pay between 800 or 700 to $1 million or $1.1 million. The corporations came in and they paid him $3 million, $4 million, and so on. So the guy said, okay, I'm selling it immediately. But they told him, but you have to stay for a few years and this and that, and you got to follow our leads. And you were, so I don't know, but I've heard a lot of people, like, they're not very happy when they sell it to corporations. They lost the touch. And, like, you know, we veterinarians, we give a lot of things for free. We just, if someone comes in with, and they can't afford it, we compromise, we bend over backward for them. All of us, not only me. I'm sure you did the same thing. You gave a lot. Incorporation, no, you're a freaking number. We'll charge you for everything we do, even the cotton balls. And so the guys, the public, and then prices are high, which is kind of good for us, because if I charge for a procedure, let's say $3,000 or $4,000, and they charge $15,000 or $20,000, I go, whoa. Let's say splenectomy. I heard that splenectomy, they're charging $15,000. Whoa! Because I can do it in less than half an hour, because I have the ligature, faster than anything, cleaner than anything, and get out. And if I charge $5,000, I feel like, oh boy, I charged them too much.
Right.
But I kind of, it's good for me, because they know when they come in, they're going to have a personal relationship, personal service, and cheaper, much cheaper.
Yeah, the cost of care is one of my fears with the profession. We're making it a luxury item to own a pet.
Yes, that's the revolution. That's the revolution.
So do you believe that there is some cahoots going on between veterinary pet insurance companies and corporations?
I'm not that smart. I don't know. I can't go that deep. I'm just having fun cutting cases one after the other. Don't give a shit about anything. You know, just do it.
Well, heaven forbid someone comes in and you have to do surgery on it and it has sugar in its urine. You're screwed. What are you going to do? You won't be able to do surgery on that dog for a while. Man, you're the first specialized general practitioner I think I've ever met as far as how much you love to do surgery.
I can't call myself a specialist.
No, specialized general practitioner.
But I can say I'm an orthopedic surgeon because I've done shitload of orthopedics and I've published in little things here and there. Dr. Vassar was the guy I used to give him the reports, and he used to publish it for me. So I have 4 or 5, and then I got busy. So mm-hmm. I had to make a living first. So I went to doing the research.
So how important would you say it is for these young veterinarians when they come out, start socializing and meeting other veterinarians? Because it sounds like for you, the networking was huge. It opened up many other doors for you. Not just referrals, but just being able to learn stuff.
Yes, it did. I mean, I had colleagues that referred me cases. We had fantastic time. Some colleagues, I used to go to them to their hospital and help them in surgeries when they needed it. Some colleagues, they do certain things. I tell them, okay, I wouldn't do it this way. Let's do it this way. So it's fun communicating with colleagues. Very fun. And then doing, in my point of view, the surgery is what's keeping me going. It's fun.
What if I said to you right now, you have to start going back into exam rooms?
I do for consults and stuff like that for my orthopedic cases.
Right.
And but don't tell me to treat a heart or treat Addisonian like you do. And
well, what if you had to talk to a client about that?
About what?
Any of that stuff.
I'm lucky. I have associates with me that they are better than me. I have a doctor that I relieved the pain of surgery from him. He doesn't have to go and stay for half an hour, 45 minutes or an hour to do surgery on a big dog to do his pay. And then he loses his concentration. I took that pain away from him. Let him only do practice, general practice, as much as he wants. And then, thank God, we have the mobile specialists like the radiologists. So that gave us the ultrasound. I don't have to make a diagnosis myself.
Yeah, the specialist that comes in.
Specialist comes in and mm-hmm. does the ultrasonographer, does it. And so it's fun. General practice by itself, if you want to do everything by yourself, I did it about 20 years, but I really didn't like it. It's too much. We have so many information and there's so many new things. Like, you know, every year or year and a half, the whole thing is, you got new stuff. I can't keep up.
The latest one that blows me away is that everyone's shuns you if you use metronidazole for diarrhea because you're ruining the gut biome. And I'm like, if you have a client that comes in with a dog that has diarrhea, mm-hmm. you better make that diarrhea go away or they're going to go find somebody who will make that diarrhea go away.
Yep.
So, you know, in research, obviously the animals' lives are very important. We want them to live forever. I'm not arguing that, but there's some times where just clients want to get the problem solved because they have 3 kids at home and then they can't walk their dog 6 times in the middle of the night because they're having diarrhea. Or even worse, pick up diarrhea off the carpet in the morning. Oh, that fires them up. Yeah, I remember one time I had a new grad come out and vet school scared them so much of cortisone, right? Mm. Scared them so much of cortisone that she would only give shots of Benadryl to itching dogs.
And Dream On. and dream on.
Right. I mean, again, I mean, things that have changed. We have new environmental allergy injections and pills. We have arthritis injections now.
Yes.
And of course, you read online, everyone's like, oh, this killed my dog, this killed my dog, this did that. That's all fucking bullshit. Yeah. You know what? There's usually something that's going on that probably would have shown its face at some point. And my argument is, if it did, was your dog comfortable? Was he able to finally walk again? You know? What's more important at this point, quality of life or longevity? And you have clients that have a hard time with it, and they'll destroy you for that. So you were a surgeon. I'm pretty sure, I'm not saying it happened a lot, but with as many surgeries as you did, you never got the outcome you wanted. How did you handle those conversations?
This is like a knife in your chest when something happens and it didn't go right. That kills you. It kills me. I freak out.
Still to this day.
To this, I cannot do anything unless I did it at least 50 times. it's like I don't do arthroscopy for this because I know the learning curve is very high, and whoever is have done a lot of damage, even if they're expert. I don't like to take that chance. I'm lucky I'm doing things that I know how. I did it a lot, and I keep doing it. And you get good results over 95%, 98%, you're okay. If it's less than that, if it's 90 or 80%, that means you're going to be stabbed 2 times in the chest. I call it in the chest because it's my chest. That is bad. But I look around that I want to be sure that I'm not backward. I didn't miss something that important. And in surgery, it's before and after. Before and after. And you have to get used to get slapped. And the worst person who slaps you, it's yourself. You know, it's terrible. We all have done that. Actually, when my kids became MDs and PhDs and lawyers, I came in and told them, look, sit down. I want to talk to you. And I had a conversation with them. I tell them, you have the work ethics, which is fantastic. Secondly, you went to good schools in the United States. You got the best education that is there. Now, that doesn't mean you're not going to fuck up and do a mistake. So you're going to do a mistake, and you're going to do a stupid mistakes. So this is what I told my kids, not while they were young. No. To ruin them, no. When they graduated.
That was third grade? Was that when you dropped them off for third grade?
No. So, and I told them, if you do mistakes, remember, it's not you. You're not the stupid. It's your genes that has stupid genes. And I tell them a history about our family, old family, how they were stupid. So I tell them, you know that stupid genes? Remember, you have it. If it happens, don't blame yourself. Blame the genes. As long as you're doing your best, you'll do your best, and then the rest, like the French says, what do you want me to do? Do a harikiri? No. Shit's gonna happen.
Well, I mean, and that's, you know, that brings up two questions I want to ask. First one, is you have a lot of veterinarians coming out nowadays. You said you have some young veterinarians working for you. How many of them are afraid to do a procedure because that was a procedure they should refer? I'm not talking about orthopedics. I'm just talking like splenectomy, cystotomy.
It depends who's the surgeon in that area. And I have a guy, he is, I call it chicken shit, he's very sensitive with his clients, and he does the general surgery, but he does it, but he trusts me completely, and he saw my work. Thank God. He was trained in a university, and he was treated like a piece of shit, like just do anesthesia, don't do anything else. And the orthopedic surgeon, he couldn't even tell him good morning. And then the guys, when that was the time the TPLO was starting, and then he comes in to me, and I do it in 45 minutes or so, and I leave, and he goes, what, you're doing, you're doing this, and you're having fun, you're not cranky or anything. I say, yeah, fun. You look at him before and after, beautiful, done. Next. So the guy trusts me completely, and he doesn't want to do, because not everybody should do like even space. Sometimes it's hard. Hey, 2 years ago I had a complication of freaking castration. Come on, guy, how many castration have we ever done? With thousands. And you get it. So you go and sat on, went ahead and bleeding, went and held it. My associate was with me, almost fainted. He said, I don't know what you're doing. So I controlled it, done, finish. Solved the complication. But even in castration in a big dog, you have to be careful. You have to be careful. Nothing is called routine. And then a guy like me, who he was trained with the fast and make a little incision, which is bullshit. That you feel that you're the king of the... No, shit can happen still. I don't care. Shit can happen. In castration, you can make... I've heard, besides the seromas and the swelling and this and that... And some guy, he cut the urethra. Well, you never know.
There was a client that left my practice, went somewhere else, and they neutered the dog, and they ligated the urethra.
Yeah, I heard that. I could never think about it. But
how? I mean,
if the dog is fat and stuff like that, shit can happen. You want to hear a funny story?
I love funny stories.
Okay.
That's why I have you here. You're starting to open up.
When I used to do TPOs and orthopedics and stuff, I used to get referrals. My house is always open, and my hospital is always open, like you know. Anybody can come in and watch as long as you're dressed properly and you breathe.
Breathe is huge.
Very important. Yes,
very important.
You have to breathe. And if you're bad, tell me before you fall on the,
before you hit
on the floor.
The
floor.
Right.
So I made it easy. So the guy came in, saw me doing a TPO, two or three times. He says, I can't do it. And I told him, John, if I do it, you can do it. She's wrong. Very wrong. I have training and years of experience. I used to think, if I do it, anybody can do it. No. I learned it the hard way. So what did John do? He goes ahead and he wants to do the TPO. So he goes, cut his pubic area, first cut, and then he does the second cut. And then he wants to bend the ilium so he can put a plate, and he couldn't. For God, he couldn't. What he did, and in his bad luck, it was a fat dog. So when he comes in the pubic area, he missed the pubic area. He went to the other side, and he cut the other leg's femur, head of neck of the femur. It was bad, and I felt bad about him. I said, Chuck, why did you call me? And he stayed 6 hours. So now, when someone wants to learn something, a procedure from me, I go ahead, see it once or twice, and I told him, close your eyes, and here is the bone. Tell me what you're going to do. If you can't do it blindly, don't do it.
Right.
I learned it the hard way.
Right. My wife had an associate that came out, I don't know how long ago it was, and a block Tom came in, mm-hmm. and she wanted to refer it immediately. She didn't want to unblock it because school had told her that block Toms need to go right to the emergency room.
I mean, here is the difference between general practice and the degrees of their knowledge and a guy who comes in wants to refer everything because he doesn't have the general knowledge experience. That's it.
So, I mean, you're a perfect example of how important mentorship is.
Extremely important.
So if you were to talk to, let's just say, a good friend of yours, their child is graduating vet school, what would you tell them to look for in a mentor?
I would tell them to go and look, volunteer. Even if he becomes a veterinarian, if he is interested in one thing, continue your education. If you're interested, let's say, in ophthalmologist, go ahead and take more continuing education. If you have a big practice, multiple practice, you do, let's say, general practice, you do skin this, I do ultrasound. Now we have a CT scan. I bought a freaking CT scan, which I have no idea what's going on. But there is a new graduate coming. I told him, look, I want you to study ultrasonography very well and CT scans very well. Go to all the lectures, attend all the stuff, go and talk about it so we can refer cases to you. And he refers it to the boarded
radiologist
and stuff like that, mm-hmm. and reads it. Because not everybody knows everything, you know. My guy knows dermatology and general practice is fine. We have a problem, we have the radiologist coming in. The cardiologist, we have a cardiologist coming in. We're in an area, we're very lucky. We can have a cardiologist coming into our practice. So we're lucky to have that. If you are in an area where, let's say, in the middle of nowhere, you have to learn how to do those things the hard way.
Yeah. And, you know, the thing is, I just want, you know, these early career veterinarians understand you're expected to make mistakes, but don't let those mistakes, learn from them, don't scare you away from thinking you could ever do it again, right?
Yep.
So I mean, that's the biggest thing for me is, wow, someone really wants you.
I don't want them.
You don't want them?
Sorry, let me.
It could be Egypt.
Yep, I wish. Okay, here.
Oh, you got the new 16 too.
Yep.
Yeah. So, last thing I want to touch on, because you're a man that has done a lot of this. How big was entrepreneurship for you?
What do you mean by entrepreneurship?
Well, how many businesses do you own now?
Okay. I bought a big lot. It's about an acre. Because I thought I'm going to make a referral place. There was only one referral place at that time, which is Grand Avenue Pet Hospital. And everybody was not very happy. Now we have 10 referral places.
Right.
And so I bought it. And then my accountant said, your hospital is about 4,000 square foot. You don't need any more. Let me build an office building above it and do this, this, and that. And then I didn't know. We're going to build in Newport, and we're going to have a real estate. We're going to. So I asked an older gentleman, God bless his soul, an older broker, I think. A broker, something like that, or a real estate broker, something. So he said, George, Dr. K, you are not a builder. Yeah, why? What I advise you is do the things that you've been practicing for 15, 20 years. Do the things related to your business. Everything related to your business. Anything related to your business. So I filled up the boarding. So I built up a boarding facility. And then I had my associate and I liked surgery. So I devoted another 25 years doing orthopedic surgeries and doing and getting good at it. And then I got hit by cancer of the prostate, but I'm okay now. 20 years ago, you get hit, you go, oh my God, you're gonna die, bullshit. So you go from one hospital to another, you discuss with 10 other doctors, everybody has his own little things. So I was coming from Loma Linda by myself, and I said, look, God, if you are there, I will never complain again. Just give me the power to work from as soon as I wake up until I sleep. Give me the power to work. And since then, I started other companies. I opened other companies. I opened the cremation afterwards. So, and thank God my colleagues helped me tremendously with that. And you were one of my patients until you get sold. You got sold. but you had nothing to do with it. And yeah. And then I had the Dr. K's medical equipment and supplies. I helped young doctors. They want an autoclave in spending $6,000. I give it to them with $2,500. They're very happy. Everybody, a new doctor wants an electrocautery. ESU, I give it to him and I teach him and stuff like that. A new doctor wants to have a triad. Instead of paying $15,000 or $20,000, I give it to him with between $7,000 to $10,000. And I make it easy for him until he likes it and he loves it. And then I opened a company called Sharp Sterilization because we were doing the cremation. Let's open this up. And then lately I have the CBD. Some guy from the Midwest, I can make you a doggy CBD. He did the CBD and we're having this company, but I don't market for it or anything like that. I'm too busy.
You owned another hospital too, right?
I used to own two other hospitals, sold them. And I used to own an emergency clinic. The emergency clinic next to me that used to have 35 doctors owning it, they went bankrupt or they were going to go bankrupt and they sold it to me. Because I was the only one who says, hey, no, it's going to be fine. It's going to be fine, this and that. So not bad. I bought it, and at the end of, after 7 or 8 years, I sold it to a surgeon in there.
That's right, though. You own that emergency clinic because I brought my Chihuahua there when she was seizuring.
Yeah, here you go.
And you found out I was there, and you came over to make sure everything was okay.
Here you go.
George, you are an amazing man.
God bless you. Thank you.
I hope, like, your type of story can help these other ones that are so worried. So I got one more question, and then I have two more questions, and we'll wrap up. Number one, if you could change anything with the veterinary education right now, what would it be?
Veterinary education. I would tell them, you have the best education. That doesn't mean you're not going to make mistakes. You have to learn how to forgive yourself. It's hard. But tell them, in the United States, there's the basic education, which is your university or your school, but there is other educations every year, every month, in areas. If you like something, just go and re-educate yourself. Continue your continuing education constantly. I used to have more than 150 hours of continuing education a year. That's a lot. And that's the only thing that I tell my kids. Hey, I thank my ex-wife, your mom, that she let me go and do continuing education to get better, to feel more confident. So the education is available for you. Don't think you're going to graduate, you're going to know everything. No, you don't. But if you like something, go for it, continue. You get better with experience and with knowledge. And the knowledge is available in the United States. It's available. You have Western states, Central states, Eastern states. You have in each items, internal medicine seminars, surgery seminars, orthopedic seminars. Always.
Always.
Is there. So grow. It's a very good profession. Grow, but don't try to become a specialist in everything.
I tried.
No, you can't. That's it.
I tried. I tried.
That is a torture.
But I was just like you. I go to ACVIM. I go to orthopedic. Mm. I go to ophthalmology. I mean, ACVIM, though, in my opinion, because I like the medicine. I love surgery, but I like the medicine part. Mm. ACVIM for me was such a cool conference to go to, because there's a section where they go over the research, and every 15 minutes they change subjects. I can't sit in a lecture hall, and listen to an hour and a half on TPLO, on elbows, on heart, on liver. I can't do it. And a lot of these conferences dedicate one whole day to one organ or one arm or one leg, like all the procedures and stuff. I can't do that. So you used to go to the surgery conference.
A lot.
You loved that conference.
A lot.
You loved it.
Yeah.
I bet you were the life of the party there too, weren't you?
Oh, no. Afterwards, yes.
Afterwards. Yes. Okay, last question. And every one of us has one of these. What is the one craziest thing, case, client, more importantly, client interaction that you remember?
Okay. This client comes in, familiar, angry like hell. Dog is 15 years old. I'm upset. What happened? We didn't have computer at that time. We had still in the papers and stuff like that. So she goes, I'm upset at you. My dog took him boarding. He had blood in urine. They took him to their own vet He had cancer of the prostate, and we had to put him to sleep. And I go, wait a minute. I'm usually talk to you, but I at that time I used to do general practice. I talk to you about the castration. I'm pro castration, especially after the age of 5 or so. So yeah. Whenever I came in for anything, you talk to me about it. And I go, for the last 10 years, I said, okay, for the last 10 years, I told you about castration, bug the shit out of you every time you come in. Yeah, yeah. I said, and the dog got cancer after 15 years. Why are you so upset at me? You know what she said? She said, you told me, but you didn't push me.
I remember that.
He didn't.
You told me that story before. I remember.
Yeah.
You told me, but you didn't push me.
Well, we suggest, asshole. We say it a year after a year.
Right.
You don't want to fucking do it? That's your problem.
I agree.
So that's the story that is.
That's the one that you remember.
I'll never forget that. You didn't push me.
Exactly. And see, those are the types of things that just eat at you. Like when they do, but you learn as you build your professional identity and you become who you are, you learn to just laugh at that shit. Because at some point, what was I going to do? Should I hold your hand into anesthesia with your dog and say, okay, I'm going to do it now? It's crazy.
I told her for the last 10 years, you don't get it? Fuck you.
I agree with you. Yes, I finally got the George I wanted right there in the closing. I wanted that the whole time. You're so reserved.
You know.
Well, George, if anyone wants to contact you about your crematorium or your Dr. K medical supplies or your sterilization, how can they get a hold of you?
They can call me or...
Is Dr. K's medical supplies, you have a website?
No. I'm very... Dr. K is very disorganized. I have a warehouse or two full of medical stuff. I don't know what I have even. But it's not made for... to make... And I lost a lot of money in it, but I don't... I make it for... mainly my fun, because I help my associates, but I get a lot of material. I help myself too, definitely first. And then I see medical stuff from the human field when they throw it away. I go ahead and see new stuff. And so I had fun with it. They can call me, or you can call me at my number, personal number. If you're a doctor or a manager or stuff, call me at 949-500-0516. Just don't call me at night and bug me, okay?
And then our...
Nothing can, after
can
11.
Can they also contact you through another website at all?
They can call Back Bay, or they can call Back Bay Veterinary Hospital. 949-756-0554, or only cremations itself, and they ask for me. My son, who is a PhD, he's helping me for 3 days there.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
He was also helping with the sterilization, right?
Yes, he does both.
He does both, yeah. So this is another episode of Irreplaceable Truths. I hope you enjoyed this chat with Dr. Kacharian. We'll have him on again, and I hope he's not so reserved next time, because he's just like me. He has many opinions and very few filters. Reminder about that prostate cancer. The only reason you shouldn't rectal a dog, there's two reasons you shouldn't rectal a dog. Either you don't have a finger or the dog doesn't have a butthole.
If you have any other questions, you can contact me at drg@vetmedit.com, or check us out at Rebuy Studios. Talk to you soon.